Hi, this is Evan Karish, Editor-in-Chief of Anesthesiology, with some highlights from the February 2019 issue as selected by the journal editors. We begin this month with a clinical study that examines whether patients with obstructive sleep apnea have increased sensitivity to opioid-induced ventilatory depression. Dr. Anthony Dufas of Stanford University and colleagues there and elsewhere tested the hypothesis that patients with moderate to severe obstructive sleep apnea are more sensitive to remifentanil-induced ventilatory depression than patients without sleep apnea. 30 patients with obstructive sleep apnea and 20 controls received a brief remifentanil infusion during continuous monitoring of ventilation. The authors estimated effect site concentrations using a published pharmacologic model. They also modeled minute ventilation as a function of effect site concentration and the estimated carbon dioxide concentration. The model described the observed minute ventilation with reasonable accuracy. The study estimated a remifentanil effect site concentration associated with 50% of maximum effect. That estimated concentration was 2.3 nanograms per mil in patients with obstructive sleep apnea and 2.1 nanograms per mil in patients without obstructive sleep apnea. This difference was small and not statistically significant. None of the tested covariates, which also characterize sleep apnea, had a significant effect on the remifentanil effect site concentration associated with 50% of maximum effect. The model suggested that the effect of obstructive sleep apnea on that effective remifentanil effect site concentration was less than 5%. The authors concluded that obstructive sleep apnea status, apnea-hypopnea events per hour of sleep, or minimum nocturnal oxygen saturation measured by pulse oximetry did not influence the sensitivity to remifentanil-induced ventilatory depression in awake patients. This is an important consideration in the care of patients with obstructive sleep apnea. Our next study examines a possible rescue treatment for postoperative nausea or vomiting after failed prophylaxis. This prospective, multi-center study tested the hypothesis that intravenous amisulpride, a dopamine D2 and D3 antagonist, is superior to placebo at treating postoperative nausea or vomiting after failed prophylaxis. Out of 2,285 adult patients who received standard antiemetic prophylaxis, 702 patients experienced postoperative nausea or vomiting in the 24 hours after surgery. These 702 patients were randomized to one of three arms to receive a single dose of 5 milligrams of intravenous amisulpride, 10 milligrams of intravenous amisulpride, or placebo. The primary study endpoint was a complete response, defined as no emesis or rescue antiemetic use for 24 hours after rescue drug administration. Dr. Ashraf Habib of Duke University and colleagues elsewhere found that 42% of patients receiving 10 milligrams of amisulpride had a complete response compared with only 29% of placebo patients, a 13% difference, which was statistically significantly greater. A 5 milligram dose of amisulpride did not show a significant benefit, with only 34% of patients having a complete response. The total number of adverse events recorded and proportion of patients with at least one adverse event were comparable between the placebo and amisulpride groups. No clinically relevant toxicities were observed. The authors concluded that a single 10 milligram dose of intravenous amisulpride was safe and more effective than placebo at treating established postoperative nausea or vomiting. Our next clinical study describes longer-term follow-up of a previous investigation. The previous work had found that a balanced hydroxyethyl starch solution was associated with better short-term outcomes than a balanced crystalloid solution for fluid support during major open abdominal surgery. Dr. Alexandra Houston of the Université Libre de Brussels, Brussels, Belgium, and colleagues there and elsewhere performed a one-year follow-up of renal and disability outcomes in patients from the previous study. The authors used modern imputation methods in mixed model regressions and chose the estimated glomerular filtration rate as their main outcome measure. They obtained follow-up data for renal function in 129 of the 160 patients enrolled in the original study. They also obtained World Health Organization disability scores for 114 of the original patients. The authors found no statistically significant differences in estimated glomerular filtration rate at 1 year. That rate was 80 mL per minute per 1.7 meters squared for crystalloid versus 74 for colloid. However, the disability score was significantly lower in the colloid group than in the crystalloid group, 2.7% versus 7.6%. Disability-free survival was higher in the colloid group, 79% versus 60%. The authors concluded that in patients undergoing major open abdominal surgery, there was no evidence of a statistically significant difference in long-term renal function between a balanced hydroxyethyl starch solution and a balanced crystalloid solution. However, disability-free survival was significantly higher in the colloid group. The next investigation addresses acute respiratory distress syndrome, or ARDS. We know that in hospital mortality of ARDS is approximately 40%, but the trajectory and degree of underdiagnosis of the newly classified mild ARDS remains unknown. Dr. Tai Pham of the University of Toronto and colleagues there and elsewhere set out to describe the natural history and associated factors in this population. They analyzed patients from the International Prospective LungSafe trial who had initial mild ARDS their first day of inclusion. The study defined three groups based on the evolution of severity in the first week as either worsening, persisting, or improving. Among 580 patients with initial mild ARDS, 18% had continuous improvement. Just over one-third of patients had persisting mild ARDS, and nearly half of the patients worsened in the first week after ARDS onset. Overall, in-hospital mortality was 30%. Among patients with improving ARDS, 10% died. Mortality was 30% in patients with persistent ARDS and 37% in patients with worsening ARDS. The overall median duration of mechanical ventilation was 7 days. The median duration was 3 days for patients with improving ARDS, 7 days in patients with persisting ARDS, and 11 days in patients with worsening ARDS. The authors concluded that most patients with initial mild ARDS continue to exhibit ARDS criteria in the first week, and that nearly half these patients worsen in severity. Their mortality is high, particularly in patients with worsening ARDS, emphasizing the need for close attention to this patient population. Our next study evaluated patient perceptions of physician competence, specifically the role of body language and physician sex on patient perceptions of physician competence. Dr. Catherine Forkin and colleagues at the University of Virginia tested the hypothesis that patients would perceive anesthesiologists displaying confident body language as more competent, and that patients would prefer male anesthesiologists. The authors recruited 200 adult patients presenting to the Pre-Anesthesia Evaluation and Testing Center at the University of Virginia Health System to participate. Patients viewed four 90-second videos in random order. These videos showed a male or female actor displaying confident, high-power poses or unconfident, low-power poses. Each actor recited the same script describing general anesthesia. Participants then ranked each actor anesthesiologist on perceived confidence, intelligence, and likelihood of choosing that anesthesiologist to care for their family member. Participants also chose the one actor anesthesiologist who seemed most like a leader. The investigators did not detect any differences in patient perceptions based on the anesthesiologist's sex. The authors did find that actor anesthesiologists displaying confident, high-power body language had 2.3-fold greater odds of being ranked as more confident, 1.7-fold odds as being seen as more intelligent, and were more likely to be chosen to care for a family member with an odds ratio of 2.3. These actors were also more likely to be considered a leader with an odds ratio of 2.6. The authors concluded that patients perceive anesthesiologists who display confident body language as more competent, more intelligent, more like a leader, and are more likely to choose that anesthesiologist to care for their family member. Our next study is a laboratory investigation in mice. It explores whether opioid use immediately after surgery and trauma may worsen outcomes in a mouse model. Dr. Wenwu Li of Stanford University and colleagues there and at Veterans Affairs Palo Alto Healthcare System attempted to determine whether morphine administered for a clinically relevant time period in a tibia fracture orthopedic surgery model adversely affected postoperative recovery in mice. The investigators gave mice morphine twice daily for 7 days after unilateral tibial fracture and intramedullary pin fixation. They measured mechanical allodynia, limb-specific weight bearing, gait changes, memory, and anxiety after injury. They also assessed the effects of a selective toll-like receptor 4 antagonist on nociceptive and functional changes after injury. They found that tibial fracture caused several weeks of mechanical nociceptive sensitization. This change was exacerbated by the perioperative administration of morphine. They also found that injured limb weight bearing, gait, and object location memory were worse in morphine-treated fracture mice than in untreated fracture mice. Neuroinflammation involving toll-like receptor 4 receptor-expressing microglia was observed. A toll-like receptor 4 antagonist improved nociceptive sensitization for about 2 weeks in morphine-treated fracture mice. The authors concluded that morphine treatment, beginning at the time of injury, impairs nociceptive recovery and other outcomes. Measures preventing glial activation through toll-like receptor 4 signaling may reduce the adverse consequences of postoperative opioid administration. Our clinical focus review article this month focuses on the quadratus lumborum block. In this recently described fascial plane block, ultrasound is used to guide the injection of local anesthetic adjacent to the quadratus lumborum muscle, with the goal of anesthetizing the thoracolumbar nerves. Dr. Hesham El-Sharkawi of the Cleveland Clinic and colleagues elsewhere in Ohio, the UK, and Australia discuss relevant concepts, mechanisms, and techniques, noting that an understanding of the relevant anatomy and technical aspects of the quadratus lumborum block are essential for its effective and safe use. They report that cadaveric studies demonstrate that the iliohypogastric and ilioinguinal nerves are consistently involved. Quadratus lumborum block approaches are named in reference to injection location in relation to the quadratus lumborum muscle. Current indications are based on few existing randomized controlled trials and case reports. Although the evidence base is weak, the data thus far suggest that quadratus lumborum block potentially results in extensive sensory blockade from T7 to L2. Quadratus lumborum block may lead to the dermatomal coverage required for abdominal surgery and hip surgery, representing an avenue for further research. Finally, this month's review article focuses on benchmarking and comparing anesthesiology group productivity. Dr. Amir Abouliash of the University of Texas Medical Branch in Galveston, Texas, and colleagues note that making these comparisons is an essential activity of data-driven management. For clinical anesthesiology, accomplishing this task is a daunting effort if meaningful conclusions are to be made. For anesthesiology groups, productivity analysis must be done at the facility level in order to reduce some of the confounding factors. When industry or external comparisons are done, then the use of total ASA units per anesthetizing sites allows for overall productivity comparisons. Additional productivity components, such as total ASA units per hour, hours per case, or hours per operating room per day, can allow for leaders to develop productivity dashboards. With the emergence of large groups that provide care in multiple facilities, these large groups can choose to invest more effort in collecting data and comparing facility productivity internally with group-defined measurements, including total ASA units per full-time equivalent. I'll close this month by drawing your attention to the debut in anesthesiology of a new article type, Understanding Research Methods. This new article type is the first of what will be a larger family of articles, the Reader's Toolbox. We envision this as continuing methodologic education in the realm of research, analogous to continuing medical education in the clinical domain, for readers who want to understand not only the what of journal content, but also the how by which it was obtained. Understanding Research Methods articles will present existing and emerging research methods that are or will become relevant to anesthesiology research and implemented into clinical practice. Join me in exploring our first Understanding Research Methods article by Drs. David Story and Alan Tate on methods in survey research. Please let me know your thoughts and suggestions for future topics in Understanding Research Methods or future article types in the Reader's Toolbox. Thank you for listening.